misty mountains cold.
Is this that Hobbit shit?
Welcome to That Hobbit Shit. I'm Corey.
And I'm Mike.
Hey there, Mike.
Hey, Corey.
What what chapter are we doing on today's episode?
Well, Corey, my heart is down in my toes because we are doing chapter 16, otherwise known as A Swish and a Plop.
Very nice title. I like that.
My alternative title was The Ring Goes Souther.
I would have accepted either.
So, in case you've forgotten, when we last left our little heroes, they had just been defeated by the mountain.
Yes.
So they started this chapter at the foot of the mountain, regrouping. Our cowards were having cowardly feelings. In an attempt to increase morale, stingy old Gandalf shared his elven wine quite sparingly, one mouthful each. They discussed whether or not to give up. The only other option was taking a pretty ominous sounding shortcut. After some prodding by the hobbits, Gandalf explained that the shortcut was through the mines of Moria. Gimli started vibrating with excitement. Boromir, not liking the sound of that, stubbornly suggested again that they go around the mountains, almost as if he had not been paying attention for the last several months.
Oh yeah, it has been months, hasn't it?
Gandalf and Boromir get into a bit of a dick measuring contest while Gimli continues to vibrate to the side. He's so pumped up.
With reason.
Yeah, with reason. They all take a vote. As any democratic party would. Aragorn and Gimli are in. Sam, Merry, Pippin, Legolas, and Boromir are all firmly out. Even though the majority are against traveling to Moria, Frodo suggests they wait until the morning. It's getting dark, and there is a fell voice on the wind, a howling wind. No, you idiot, says Aragorn. That's wolves. Gandalf says, well, guess we'll have to go through Moria. We'll wait until the morning, though, provided we can survive.
You might have just spawned a fan theory in my mind, but go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I have one myself.
Excellent.
provided we can survive without being eaten.
You made like six Sam references already. This is wonderful.
It's a Sam heavy episode. A Samisode, if you will. They climb to the top of the hill they're sheltering beside. It's surrounded by trees and gives them pretty nice shelter. They build a nice toasty fire and they all settle in for the night. They continue to hear howling, and then they see a giant wolf shape enter the ring of firelight. Gandalf stands up and starts talking shit, and while he is squaring up to the wolf, Legolas shoots it through the throat. All the howling stops and everyone settles down. Just as everybody's falling back asleep, the howling picks up again and they're attacked from all sides by wolves. Boromir, Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli start to killing. For the first time up until this point, 400 or so pages into the book, Gandalf does something. He sets the whole hill on fire. The wolves cried, "This MFer is crazy," and all ran away. Everyone went back to sleep. The morning came and they couldn't find a single dead wolf anywhere. Interesting, Corey.
Very suspicious, yes.
Very suspicious. They ate a single breakfast, and Gandalf pointed vaguely off in some direction, and they all followed him towards wherever he was leading them. They wandered through the mountains all day long and eventually found this dried up little stream. Apparently, that is the exact stream Gandalf was looking for. They followed it for some ways, and they found a dried up waterfall.
Again, going well.
This is the area Gandalf was looking for. Somehow ominously changed since he was last there. climb up where the waterfall used to be and find that it had been dammed. There is a vast lake in front of the foot of the mountain. They look around and it's just a sheer rock wall. And over on the far side, they see some ancient trees. No door, just some trees.
It's very important that there is no door.
They scoot around. They take the long way around the lake because they all vote they don't want to enter the water, and make their way over to the ancient trees, which happen to be holly trees, giant holly trees. Still no door. Gandalf explained there's actually a super secret puzzle only he could solve. And while he did solve, while he was solving it, they should start getting ready. And also offhandedly, he mentions that Bill the pony's not going to be able to go.
I feel like he doesn't even mention Bill by name at that point.
No. Oh, and you can't bring the stinky pony in here. Sam was inconsolable. In an effort to placate him, Gandalf pretended to give Bill some magic words like Tom Bombadil would have. Everyone else stood around awkwardly, not knowing exactly what was going on. Gandalf wandered over and started putzing around with the door puzzle again. He did a bit of razzle-dazzle, and the outline of a door appeared, a fantastic door. It had an elaborate design with trees and a star and some elvish writing that said, "Say friend and enter." Gandalf explained, "You see, this is a magic door, and you need a secret password that I don't know." Everyone was pretty angry. Gandalf led them to a dead end with wolves chasing them, and he made some half-hearted threats towards everybody and said, "I need to sit down and think." He went through every common password he knew, and nothing was working.
And he knew a lot.
Every magic word from elves, dwarves, and men, I believe he said. Out of boredom, cool guy Boromir started throwing rocks into the water. There was a swish and a plop, and something started moving at the far end of the lake. Back at the door, old Gandalf had an epiphany. He said, "Friend," in Elvish, and the door opened.
Hey. Remember
when he read it and it said, "Speak, friend, and enter"? As everyone got up to get in, got up to enter the door, Frodo screamed. A gross tentacle had grabbed him. Everyone turned around to see the entire lake was alive with many gross tentacles. As the tentacle fingered Frodo, Samwise the Brave...
It does say that.
Samwise the Brave ran in and started knifing it. It does say that. He cut it real good and it dropped Frodo. Everyone ran through the doorway as the tentacle started fingering everything. They fingered the cliff wall, they fingered the door, they fingered the trees, and they fingered the door so hard that they slammed it shut, leaving Bill behind.
Yeah.
Probably being fingered.
I'm going to mute my mic for a minute.
This is all from the text, Corey.
Oh, I know.
Gandalf cast a flashlight spell and led everyone along for a bit until they found an area where they could sit down and eat and calm a bit. Feeling pretty guilty about what he put them through, he offered them all a bit more of his elven wine, one mouthful each.
That's his solution to everything.
Once everyone was good and buzzed, Gandalf let it slip that they had 40 miles of traveling ahead of them. Once they were well rested, they set off, with Gandalf and Gimli leading the way. They wandered through many twisting corridors with several brief stops for Gandalf to have a good think. As they walked, Frodo could swear he heard the sound of soft bare feet slapping away behind them. Better keep that one.
Not another hobbit.
Well, we'll see. Better keep that one to himself. Eventually, they came to a crossroads that Gandalf didn't know. After some deliberating, they moved into a side room to get some sleep while Gandalf thought. Inside the room was the most tempting of wells. While everyone was setting up their beds, Pippin crept over and dropped a stone into it. Gandalf freaked.
Pippin, I guess, didn't learn that quite recently someone else had thrown a stone at something and it didn't go well.
No, it didn't go well at all. About as poorly as throwing a stone could go. They all stopped in silence for a second listening, and they heard a ting, 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 what Gimli assured them was hammering far below. And he's a dwarf. He knows hammering. Eventually it stopped and they all went into a fitful sleep, taking turns on watch. Gandalf woke them up 6 hours later when he had decided on the correct path to take. He led them for a 15-mile trek through the dark mines, eventually coming to a huge room, cranked up his flashlight, and illuminated a giant hall carved of stone. Everyone was impressed but Sam. They laid down for another sleep while they could. Frodo was on first watch, and he swore he could see two pale eyes in the distance. Better keep that one to himself.
I was going to say it if you didn't.
The next morning, they woke, had some breakfast, and explored a bit. They wandered into a corridor lit by a skylight of sorts, and they found a tomb. It was Balin's tomb, Corey. He had died in the mines of Moria. The end.
I'm a little jarred by that ending.
That's exactly how it ends, too.
Yes, it is. not ominous in the least.
No. There are a few ominous points. quite a chapter.
Yes, yeah. It could have potentially been two chapters. One with like the door being fingered shut, and one after that.
Probably should have been.
Once again, Mike, you did a very good job really just like laying out the situation in practical terms for us. So shall we get into notes?
Yeah, I'm just making a new one because I thought of something. You go first.
Okay. So the wolf that one hears is worse than the orc that one fears. However, where the warg howls, there also the orc prowls.
Words to live by, I would say.
So my note is, instead of seeing which one of them can shovel more fucking snow, Aragorn and Boromir are dueling their folklore. They just can't leave each other alone.
No. No, they really don't get along, do they?
No. I'm starting to think that, like... Maybe I'm being devil's advocate a bit here, but certain actions of Boromir's, he may have been driven to them by the rest of the fellowship.
Do you think he's the only normal person in the group?
Yes, I do think
that. What the fuck have I signed up for? Why don't you go, you want to go through the evil mines? Are you serious?
Your solution, don't go around the mountains, don't go under them, go through them in a place that has been sealed off to all life for 1,000 years.
Yeah. I thought it was funny how the vote was clearly leaning towards not go into the mines, but they went in anyway.
Is there a political term for that? Maybe that's just anarchy. I don't know. Yeah, Frodo's vote, I guess, was like 6.
He is the bear.
Yeah, he's the bear. Well, I can, you know what, since he's the bear, I can quickly get another note out of the way. Frodo noticed the weight of the ring on its chain for the first time.
Oh.
Yeah, very interesting.
I wonder if that will happen again.
We'll just have to read and find out.
Yeah. My first note, Moria was so evil that even the hobbits had heard of it.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
As we know, hobbits don't really care about anything outside of their, you know, quarter mile existence.
Yeah, no kidding. And the further souther that they get, it is less likely that they know anything about anything.
Yeah, even the king who rules over them. So Moria must be a bad place if they've heard of it, if they even care.
Yeah, it's got a shit reputation, that's for sure. Well, speaking of hobbit shit, Gandalf mentions the Madam House at Mickledelvin.
Yes, he does. I left it out of my summary, but he does.
Which is very exciting. You can just imagine him like going through that place, just sussing it for anything of any value.
And not finding anything.
Well, yeah. But if he did find something, you can guarantee he'd steal it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He'd probably just take it and they wouldn't even notice.
Just slipping silver spoons up his sleeves.
That tentacle monster, Corey.
Yes.
I have a funny point and a serious point. I think it's really cool how Tolkien slipped those things into the book. Every once in a while, they come across something that like never is mentioned again, and it's just this implied evil that exists. It's almost like Lovecraftian and some of the shit that he slides in there.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very good point.
And like a many-tentacled monster that slurped out of the mountain.
Yeah, you know, and I was paying close attention to the description of the monster, and like he does mention like you could really imagine that monster in many ways, which I suppose is very Lovecraftian. Like how it even says that at the end of a tentacle is a finger. Like is that a metaphor or is it not a metaphor? Like it could really go either way.
And and because it's such a frantic flee from or run from it that like who knows if there were six tentacles or 600.
Yeah, exactly. Very fascinating. And also kind of cool when something is just like you could almost put it in the same category as the rock giants.
Yeah.
Where it's some fucked up thing and you're like, oh, I guess I'll never hear about that again.
Yeah. Or it could just be a giant squid in a lake. Or it could be, you know, a bunch of evil snakes attached to a gaping maw.
A reeking spout?
Yeah, a reeking spout, right? Yeah. Also, did that tentacle monster know the goblins? Well, where did it learn about fingering?
maybe it was just trying to pinch. It was it wanted nothing but pinches.
Can't pinch with its like wet, greasy hands or fingers.
It's some kind of weird, like extra normal manifestation of the goblin's desire to pinch. It's like a poltergeist.
It's been doomed to a life where it can't pinch anything, but it needs to pinch.
Oh, I'm going to have nightmares about greasy fingered pinching tonight. So segue, this chapter represents the worst days of Bill the Pony's life.
Yeah, he really goes from like almost freezing to almost being eaten to to being left with a pinch monster.
Yep. I've never had a pony myself, but I've often read in stories how wolves drive hoofed animals absolutely insane with terror.
Yeah. If only they had kept a mule or a donkey, it would have been defense against the wargs.
With all that kicking?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they'll just kick the shit out of like a wolf.
Well, maybe that's what Bill learned in Rivendell.
Or maybe what Gandalf whispered to him.
Just kick them. Yeah, yeah, very helpful, Gandalf. Thank you.
did you catch that Frodo could see further than anyone on the party, even Gandalf?
Yes.
But there was no mention of Legolas and his elf eyes.
Oh, that's a good point. I guess maybe elf eyes are less useful in the darkness.
Yeah, probably true.
Yeah, or Legolas could have also been like, I don't want to say shit scared, but like maybe just really uncomfortable this whole time.
Yeah, I bet he's pretty upset being underneath the mountain.
Yeah, and like. Probably knowing, it seems like some of the party know things about what happened in Moria and some of the party don't. And I think Legolas might be cursed with knowing.
Yeah, he probably knows. Gimli seems to have a vague notion that something bad happened, but he doesn't want to believe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gandalf knows exactly what happened, of course.
Yes, of course. But tells no one.
It tells nobody and leads them in. And Aragorn had something bad happen in there, but won't say what.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I can't help but wonder what Aragorn's experience was. something real bad happened. The memory is evil.
Some serious pinching.
Dry fingered pinching. The worst kind.
A purple nurple.
With just a sandpapery pair of fingers. Anyhow.
My last point. Gandalf never really does much.
No, you're not wrong.
This super, like, does he exist solely on like rumor of his power? Because he lights a tree on fire. Basically, that's his defense. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even solve the simplest door riddle. He leads them to a dead end. He has a flashlight on him. That's a good thing.
he's well connected. But yeah, I don't know. That's sort of like a bit of a point that I had about like Boromir is very, very practical, which we've touched on. And he is just so specifically unimpressed with Gandalf not knowing how to open the door.
Yeah, he just walks over to the corner and starts throwing rocks. He's so mad.
Well, yeah, because he's never really seen Gandalf do anything. Like, yeah. Sure, he lit those trees on fire, but it's also unclear if you pay some close attention to the narration again. Like, did Gandalf burn down half of that forest?
Yeah, and did he do anything magical, or did he just light a branch on fire and throw it into a dry tree?
Yeah, exactly. They did have a fire. Like, there was already fire burning. Yeah, I don't know. So yeah, he's not thrown down. Does he ever throw down in The Hobbit?
He blinds all of the pinching goblins underneath the mountain.
Oh yeah, and then he throws the colored fire at the wargs.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually cooler than what he does to these wargs.
Yeah, much cooler.
Interesting. Well, also, speaking of which, Mike, I think we need to talk about those wargs.
Oh, yeah.
What the fuck happened to their dead bodies?
Okay, so I had a theory, and then I removed my theory, and I think you're about to convince me of my theory.
Okay. Oh, yes. You gave me a theory earlier.
Okay, go ahead.
There were no bodies of the wargs, so it begs the question, like, were there actually wargs? And Gandalf really wanted them to go into Moria. And as soon as they heard the wolves, he was like, well, I guess that settles it. We're going to Moria. Did he conjure the wolves?
I think this is a sound theory. Sound, get it? It would explain why he didn't do anything but set this forest on fire.
Mm-hmm. And also why they couldn't find the bodies.
Couldn't find the bodies. But all of Legolas's arrows showed up fine, except for one that caught fire.
Which caught fire and then I guess burned to nothing but the tip.
Yeah.
Very suspicious. What was your theory, Mike?
That was my theory, that he faked the wolves.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, I decided to look into this because I assumed there was an answer out there somewhere. I delved into some forums for some discussion about this, and I came across the most plausible explanation I came across was, if you're ready for this, because Gandalf called one of them a Hound of Sauron, and because he used the word Nguarhoth in his tree fire spell. Nguarhoth is the plural word for werewolf in Elvish. So these wargs are theoretically at least descended from the werewolves of the First Age, which were agents of Sauron. And those werewolves were apparently evil spirits trapped in wolf shape or inhabiting the bodies of wolves. So further to that, perhaps their physical death dissolved their bodies, or like because they were just evil spirits, or perhaps the sunlight when the dawn came dissolved their bodies.
Oh, that's a lot more serious than our theories.
Oh yeah, for sure. But well, that's what you get when you go into those Tolkien forums. There are definitely no underwear jokes. But yeah, I don't know, like maybe potentially this is all hearsay. None of this is really like, I guess there's the connection of the elfish word for, because like werewolves and wargs are separate things, but since the one word means werewolf, it hinges on that. I don't know, man.
Now let me pose this theory to you. If Gandalf did make up these wolves, did the wolves that attacked the Shire decades ago exist?
My jaw is hanging open.
Or did he make those up to seem like a hero at that time too?
See, this is poetic justice, because he made them up to seem like a hero and it didn't work.
No, everyone forgot about him.
Yeah, they immediately forgot about him. Huh.
This just builds his legend, and it means he doesn't have to do anything. Everyone's afraid of him.
Yeah, that's a very good point. He's a magician. He's an illusion maker. He's a grifter. Oh, the treachery of Gandalf.
Oh, it continues. That's it for my notes, Corey.
I have one more very brief note. Mike, there's a reference to cats in this chapter.
Holy cats.
Yeah, I think it was a serious lost Mathem opportunity. The cats of Queen Baruthiel.
All right.
There's actually a decent amount of information on it, but
you looked it up.
this is the thing. This is where like this plays right into the treachery of the Mathem house. Is I looked it up expecting there to be absolutely nothing. The story of Queen Baruthiel is very clearly laid out in like Lost Tales or Unfinished Tales or something like that. I'm not going to tell you what it is, though.
Meanwhile, our Mathem, which we'll get to later, it sounds like there wasn't a whole lot, even though there should have been.
Precisely.
Awesome.
Yeah. So that's it for notes.
Great. Should we head off to the Green Dragon?
Sure. Yeah, definitely time. But the only food for the brave and true come from the Green Dragon. The Green Dragon Inn, the segment where we discuss the elvish liquor we are consuming this chapter. Mike, would you like to go first?
I would love to, Corey. Corey, in honor of our slippery pinch monster.
Yes.
I'm drinking Kelp Stout from Tofino Brewing Company.
Ooh, that's cool.
Yeah. It's a stout with a slight seaweed kind of taste to it. Briny kind of a little bit.
I was going to say like salty a little bit. But yeah, briny. Okay, cool.
A little. It's just a nice bitterness to it. Huh. It's pretty good. You know how I feel about stouts.
Yeah, and you seem fairly pleased with this one.
Yeah, it's got a sourness to it that's nice. Obviously, no IBU rating. It's being a stout.
The stouts not register on the IBU scale?
I don't think so. Not generally.
Okay.
Let me read a little bit to you from the label. If there's one sentiment that's constantly repeated among craft beer drinkers, it is, this beer is good, but it needs more seaweed. If we've heard it once, we've heard it 1,000 times.
I like what they did there.
Yeah.
It's Mike, pretty good. That's cool. Pretty is good. That the same place that makes some, was it like a gin?
I think it's a different Tofino. Oh, it could be. Could be. I know what you're talking about. There was a gin and there was a really good, was it vodka? Tequila.
Oh yeah.
I don't know. It might have been.
I mean, there could very well be multiple places of alcohol distillery in Tofino, but I just thought I'd ask.
I've never been there. Anyway, Corey, what are you drinking?
Maybe we'll record an episode from Tofino. I lost my train of thought. Yes. So. I recorded a quote for you here, Mike. Okay, so the name Moria means black chasm or black pit. And quote from the chapter is, the wildest imaginings that dark rumor had ever suggested to the hobbits fell altogether short of the actual dread and wonder of Moria. Drum roll, please. So I'm drinking Hades Imperial Coffee Stout. Yeah, for like literal hell. I was reading the can earlier, and I realized the beer part of this Imperial Coffee Stout, coincidence again, is from New Ontario Brewing in North Bay, but there is also a place called Hades Coffee, which is where the coffee comes from. So it's a collaboration beer.
Oh, we both ended up with a stout.
Fun, fancy that, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A stout for this dark chapter.
this thick mouthfeel chapter. I've got 9.2% alcohol here, Mike.
Oh my God. Wow.
It's pretty good. It also has an underlying bitterness like yours does.
Nice.
But it's quite nice. Other than that, nice and smooth. Nice and got that coffee sweetness with a sort of a beery underlying bitterness. I quite like it. It does not taste overly alcoholic, because I've noticed in my my stout wanderings lately that sometimes if something is a high alcohol percentage, you can really taste it.
Yeah.
This one doesn't, which is dangerous.
That's hot trouble, Corey.
Hot like hell.
You remember in our younger days when we bought a bunch of coffee stout and just neither of us liked it very much?
We thought we had found the like ultimate life hack.
Yeah. And then we were just like a little
coffee and beer. Yeah. No, I do remember that. I think I remember us choking them down regardless.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we were college kids.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was no going back once we had purchased it.
But look at us now.
Drinking it by choice. We've come even farther than Sam.
I wouldn't say that.
Yeah, your silence there made me feel a little awkward.
I was sipping my stout. But that's a great segue, Corey. Should we slip into the sightseeing with Sam?
I'd love to.
There's an eye opener and no mistake.
Sightseeing with Sam, our most demanded of segments. This is the segment where we discuss sites that Sam saw during the current chapter. Mike, I had a few Sam related notes actually, and I thought I'd just relegate them to sightseeing. So I've got quite a bit to say. Would you like to kick it off?
Well, I have one thing to say, Corey, but it covers a lot.
Okay.
Sam saw that every one of his friends is a fucking piece of shit.
Once again, you've brought me to the brink of spitting beer through my nose.
He was the only one that gave a single shit about Bill the Pony.
Yeah. Mike, he was also the only one who like could move himself to action when a monster attacked Frodo.
Yeah, that too.
Well, my initial note was that Sam saw Bill the Pony for the last time, which ties into that. And there's a touch of accusation in his voice when he tells Frodo that he had to choose between him and Bill.
Oh, I love it.
I have a really good Sam note that I moved down here for you. So Sam, while they're in Moria, says that the dwarves must have been busier than badgers. But I believe, Mike, that this must be a reference to when Tom Bombadil was telling them about badgers and their queer ways. Why else, I ask you, would Sam have any idea whether or not a badger is busy?
So Sam is learning.
He is learning, and he's also quoting Tom Bombadil.
He takes a couple of swipes at the dwarves, and Gimli is not happy about it.
Sam saw the gap between hobbits and dwarves widen. he also said there's an eye opener. Pardon me. He also said in this chapter, there's an eye opener and no mistake.
Yes, he did.
Very famous quote.
He also said, my heart is down in my toes.
Yes, another famous quote. This really is a Samisode. I'm troubled that you came up with the term Samisode after our Sam apology episode.
Well, I've had time to do some deep thinking.
About Sam?
About Sam.
About Sam, yeah, okay, cool. My very last Sam related note is that he laments his lack of rope, not for the last time.
He does.
Yeah.
Rope kicks himself over it.
Those big old hobbit feet.
What a good guy that Sam is. The real hero.
Growing, learning.
Probably the best time to mention it. Our pony count is down to zero, Corey.
Oh, fuck. You're right.
So pour one out for the ponies. They're going through ponies faster than Bomber goes through toilets.
For the record, for anyone keeping track of our toilet count, that's high and fast.
He went through several in the text.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
There was a confirmed one, right? Wasn't there, at least?
Mike, I think you are once again referencing the Lost episode.
maybe. But I think when we watched the movie, there might have been a confirmed toilet destruction.
Oh, yeah, that sounds about right. Which is like, it's fine when we joke about it, but when an actual, honest to God, someone made a movie about it.
Yeah.
That's not right.
Cast it into the fire!
Fan cast it into the fire. We do what Isildur couldn't. We choose actors to be our dream cast for a new version of The Lord of the Rings. And Mike, who was your fan cast this week?
Okay, Corey. I think I assigned myself Legolas.
That's true.
And I want our Legolas to have a bit more of a comedic feel.
Oh, interesting take.
So I'm casting Nicholas Holt. You might remember him from X-Men First Class, perhaps.
Perhaps from the movie Tolkien?
Perhaps. Perhaps from the TV show The Great, where he plays the Emperor of Russia, the Tsar of Russia, if you will.
Oh, no, I don't think I've seen that.
Oh, it's pretty good, and he's very funny in it.
Really?
Yeah, just a self-absorbed asshole.
Ah, I see where you're coming from with this.
He also has a bit of a strangely beautiful face, if I may say that.
Okay,
he has this boyish look about him.
Yes. I'll agree.
I really wanted to cast someone who was just hideous looking. I really considered it.
That's quite the statement, I think.
Yeah.
Just Mike.
Who are you casting, Corey?
Well, do you not like Legolas as a character?
It would have just been like thumbing my nose at the choice of Orlando Bloom in the movie, like just the polar opposite.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're forging ahead. We're making our own path with this new one.
Like playing Legolas is Ron Perlman.
So my, what a segue. You tasked me as casting Gimli, son of Cloyne.
Don't tell me you did.
Would you believe me if I cast Ron Perlman as Gimli the Dwarf?
Amazing.
Holy fuck. Well, you know, this is true. This is not a joke.
I wish I had cast Ron Perlman as Legolas.
I had a weird feeling. I was like, what if he says Ron Perlman? What if that comes up? Then I'm fucked.
Oh, that would have been so funny. He's cast as both.
He's an actor of that caliber, Mike. Well, you know, I had I didn't know who to cast for Gimli, and I actually had Ron Perlman in mind like the whole time we were doing this, because I wanted to cast him as like maybe one of the Uruk-hai. But I was like, you know what, I gotta cast Gimli. Ron Perlman's gotta be in the show.
Great choice.
Thanks. Yeah, you as well.
No explanation needed.
I'm excited for the Nicholas Holt, Ron Perlman banter.
Oh, yeah. Their buddy comedy?
Actually, yeah, this one worked great, because I was kind of thinking of Ron Perlman as Hellboy and like delivering those like cheesy one-liners.
Yeah, that's Gimli.
Yeah, and like with his comedic duo of Legolas.
Yeah, Legolas being super aloof.
Self-absorbed. I'm shocked at how well this has gone, Mike.
Yeah, great. Our cast is great, I think. Our fellowship.
It's really padding out. We've got a lot of actors now on board. Signed on. They've signed on.
Yeah, we just need a director.
Are we going to have to do that one day? Will that be our fan cast when we run out of characters?
It's just Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, you're right. It will be. And he'll have time this time instead of abandoning the Hobbit.
Yeah, yeah. It will work around his schedule.
Sam, my dear Sam.
Welcome to My Dear Sam, where we read and discuss some fan mail.
So a listener wrote in to inform us that we have omitted, glossed over, somehow failed to recognize the fame of a particular dragon, a famous dragon, Mike.
Oh, a throwback.
Yeah, so we are revisiting famous dragons during My Dear Sam.
Wow.
And the fact that someone wrote in about this dragon is actually quite a bit more than we can say about any of our other famous dragons. I'm just going to read the email that we received. Greetings, Corey and Mike. The treachery of Saruman runs deep, so you are both forgiven for not mentioning any of the Yu-Gi-Oh! Dragons. If I had to choose a bonus dragon, it would be the Blue Eyes White Dragon from the original Yu-Gi-Oh! 2000 series versus one from the countless spinoffs. A quote here, this legendary dragon is a powerful engine of destruction, virtually invincible. Very few have faced this awesome creature and lived to tell the tale. And so we are given a quote from the Yu-Gi-Oh! Blog. In the animated Yu-Gi-Oh! Series, there are only three copies of the Blue Eyes White Dragon. Slight side note, Mike, did you watch Yu-Gi-Oh?
My friend's little brother watched Yu-Gi-Oh!
Okay.
And so he was pretty into it, and he would tell me about Yu-Gi-Oh! All the time.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So I'm familiar with it, but not like deeply familiar.
Yeah, I'm aware of it, and I think I can picture like the really husky voice of Yu-Gi-Oh! Saying "Blue Eyes White Dragon."
yeah,
but I never watched it either. I think the card aspect always kind of took me out of it.
Yeah, me, I'm not really into card collectible card kind of deals either.
Yeah,
one of my failings.
it's nice that you can admit that. So back to it, wielding 3,000 attack points, which I can only assume is astronomical. The Blue Eyes White Dragon is the purest symbol of both rarity and power. Corporate billionaire Sito Kaiba owns all three of them and went through great lengths to assure that he was the only possessor of the legendary Blue Eyes White Dragon. Yugi's grandpa owned a fourth copy that was given to him by a close friend, but after defeating Yugi's grandpa in a duel, Kaiba took the Blue Eyes White Dragon from Yugi's grandpa and ripped it up so that it couldn't be used against him. End quote. Suffice it to say, its white lightning attack would have sent the Nazgul flying. And I wonder, perhaps, if that is a reference in the letter to Gandalf on Weathertop, sending some guys flying.
Gandalf.
What would a famous dragon be if not making fun of Gandalf? This letter comes to us from listener Yasser. So thank you very much for writing to us, Yasser. And apologies that it took us approximately 90 days to respond.
Some of these episodes run long, and we wanted to make sure we gave time for the letter.
Yeah, I personally blame our multiple Sam-related segments as taking up too much time.
It's 100% Sam's fault.
Yeah, Cooking with Sam has been a real slog lately, but we've had to include it.
We don't even record that one.
We just, in our day-to-day lives, whenever we cook something, we say out loud to no one, and this is Cooking with Sam.
What's taters, Precious?
Just laughing to ourselves and cooking potatoes. What have we become, Mike? Mike, did you know that in the second age of Middle-earth that there are still dragons lurking about?
I did know that.
Mike, do you think those Amazon motherfuckers will have the balls to put a fucking dragon in that show?
They had better. They're better to be a dragon at some point, don't you think?
You think there'll be a scene of Smaug hatching?
Oh, that would be pretty shitty.
Like a prequel? And his first words are, I am fire, I am death?
Oh, man. in a cute little voice.
Benedict Cumberbatch doing a baby voice.
Yeah. Oh, that would be upsetting.
So thanks for writing to the show, and please continue to write to us if you think that there is a dragon we've missed.
Yeah, if we've slighted a dragon, please send it in.
There's nothing we like to hear about better.
The Mathem House, it was called.
Welcome to the Mathem House, where we discuss something that wasn't important enough to include anywhere else. Corey, what were you stuck with this episode?
Well, Mike, we decided that the history of Moria would be a bit much to get into, even for the Mathem House. Everyone can pause and be shocked. So, Mike, you specifically asked me to look into the importance of Moria as it pertains to the history of elf-dwarf relations.
Yes.
Yes. And relations in a political sense, not in an orgy sense. You were very clear on that point.
Oh, yes, of course. This isn't the Amazon Prime Lord of the Rings series.
Second reference. So anyhow, getting right into it, the building or carving or excavating, if you will, of Moria, or Khazad Dûm, as the dwarves called it, began in the First Age. And during the First Age, the dwarves of the Blue Mountains, which are not the Misty Mountains, I'll get to that, were friendly with elves, and they hung out with them at parties and wars and stuff, and they were cool. But the First Age ended with the defeat of Morgoth and the destruction of Beleriand, as previously discussed in the Mathem House. So where we are concerned, this all starts in the Second Age of Middle-earth. So the dwarves of the Blue Mountains suddenly find themselves more or less homeless, having much less mountain to live in, because the destruction of Beleriand destroyed most of the Blue Mountains. Sounds rather awful. And so by the year 40 of the Second Age, many of them have gone to live in Moria. So before this, Moria was more or less a pretty quiet place, and it kept to itself. So suddenly it became a bustling city of trade and friendship. The skills of the dwarves of the Blue Mountains were mixed with the skills of the dwarves of the Misty Mountains. And of course, the friendship of the Blue Mountain dwarves with the elves also came with them. And so the western gate of Moria, the doors of Durin, which our fellowship passed through in this chapter, were made in collaboration by a dwarf named Narvi and Celebrimbor the elf.
Oh,
yeah. Pretty neat. Nothing else in the annals of Tolkien history is said of our friend Narvi, which is cool. He was a good guy. But a side note is very important here. Celebrimbor the elf is, of course, the elven master craftsman who made 19 of the 20 great rings.
Yes.
Yes. And he, of course, had no hand in the making of the One Ring, but it was through some other collaboration in approximately 1500 of the Second Age that the making of the rings was possible. Why are you laughing, Mike?
Just the way you said other.
Okay, cool. I'm glad you got what I was implying. I just wanted to check. So it was approximately in the year 1600 of the Second Age. Then when Sauron, who was at that point going by his first orgy-going pseudonym, Annatar, forged in secret the One Ring. And it was with Celebrimbor and the Gwaet-y-Myrdane, which was his order of elven smiths, that they together forged the Nine and the Seven. Celebrimbor forging in secret the three elven rings. So I guess they worked together and they created their masterpieces separately. So yeah, elven rings were made separately and the One Ring was made separately. So they did not meet in the middle. So anyhow, in about 1600, as soon as Sauron put on the ring, the elven ring wearers immediately knew what he had done. And so war immediately broke out. And Durin the Third was the king of Moria at the time, and he was given one of the Seven Rings, by the way. And so then in the history, we come to the end of Moria as an elf-dwarf friendship hub in the year 1697 of the Second Age. And yes, Mike, you guessed it. It was thanks to that prick Sauron. He was warring against the elves, and the gates of Moria had to be shut. This is the year that Celebrimbor died after much torture at the hands of Sauron, asking him where the other rings had gone. And it was also the year that Rivendell was founded by our good buddy and close personal friend of the show, Elrond. And though Moria did continue to prosper after all this, keep that in mind, it was just willingly cutting itself off from the world. It was much later in the year 1981. Again, sounds very weird to read a year like that. 1981 of the Third Age that Moria was abandoned altogether, which we shall not go into this chapter. So that's essentially it. It was during the heart of the Second Age that Moria was an elf dwarf. Important friendship hub that they built a door together and elves passed through it.
So Sauron ruined another thing.
Yes. Once again, the coolest thing going on was ruined by Sauron.
A ruiner.
Yes. He was a ruiner, in fact. He ruined it. He was tricking people. They were all then deceived, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I do have a funny postscript for you, though, Mike.
Oh, please.
So while reading about Celebrimbor, none of this is in the appendices, by the way. I want you to know that. Always got to turn to the appendices first. It seems that in the Unfinished Tales, published by Christopher Tolkien, who we have not yet raised enough money to contact via seance, patreon.com/thathobbitship, that after JR's death, this was published, and a chapter in here deals with some ideas that JR played around with about Celeborn and Galadriel.
Oh, no.
Though they may or may not be official history, it seems like Christopher Tolkien said, like, this isn't actually official history. It's just an idea he threw out at some point.
Oh, no.
Yeah, here we go. One of the ideas was that Celeborn was in love with Galadriel.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mike, I fucking bet you money that this will all come up in the Rings of Power show.
Oh no, you're probably right.
Like some fucking unrequited ass love and like, please take this ring, tangle web we weave, Sauron. Like if you make a ring for her, she'll love you kind of bullshit. Like,
oh boy, I hope that's the extent of it.
Well, we'll have to see, but that's a new prediction I have for you.
I really don't need Full Frontal any Amazon series.
All joking aside, the more I read about the history of like the Second Age, I don't see how they could do the Amazon series without Full Frontal. I am being dead serious.
Oh boy.
I think it has to be like pretty brutal. Sauron tortured Celebrimbor. And asked him, you know, where are the other rings that you made so I can control them with my one ring? Once he was done torturing him, he was shot full of arrows and they hung him on a pole and carried him at the head of their army as they marched against the rest of the elves, which is like, that seems to me like Game of Thrones brutal. Like,
yeah.
This new show, if it's not rated R, then I don't know what's going to happen. Thoughts, Mike? That's about all I got for you.
I was really hoping there'd be something juicier about like the movement of goods through Moria and like, you know, how the elves came to feel they deserved so many jewels from the dwarves, that kind of thing.
I cross-referenced a lot of names and places and dates. No.
I believe you. It's just funny how this stuff isn't really explained, but we'll hear all about what's her face and her cats.
Yeah, exactly. Meanwhile, fucking Queen Baruthiel.
many,
that's
many
why
cats.
We love the Madam House.
Yeah.
I will draw you, Saruman, as poison is drawn from our wound.
And welcome to I Will Draw You Saruman, the segment of the show where we discuss the chapter illustration that one of your two favorite hosts has created. Mike, you were the host this time.
I was.
You are sending it to me.
I'm sending it to you.
That's all true. Oh my God. Oh, that's fantastic. I absolutely love it.
It's our pinchy little friend.
It is our pinchy little friend. It looks like if I pay him appropriately, he'll make me a delicious dinner.
Yeah, actually. So So there's a general design like that that's used often for takoyaki.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It's like a fried pancake ball with octopus in the center.
Yeah.
And you often places will have an illustration like this of an octopus. And actually, there's a photo we took when we went to Japan where Mariah is standing below a sign that I based this illustration off of.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, yeah. That's really cool. And did you put like a Japanese newspaper in the background?
I played around with a bunch of things with this. I threw the Japanese newspaper in the background and played with a bunch of different printmaking techniques, like trying to replicate them.
Yeah, that's crazy. This is digital?
Yeah, it's fully digital.
Ah, that's wild. That's really cool.
Thank you. I learned quite a bit about like recreating different effects in Procreate.
Yeah. You can almost see like, I assume this is one of the effects that you're looking at. Like you can almost see like sort of like a Brayer mark of like inking the thing.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I did that one on purpose.
Man, that's wild.
The offset printing kind of deal.
In the method. Yeah. Oh, that's sweet. I like
that. I had to make my own brush for that one. That was fun.
Oh, neat.
The ring at the top, I just distressed with a brush. A really low opacity.
Does that say the same thing, A Journey in the Dark?
It is a Japanese sea monster with many tentacles.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Sweet. Oh, man, that's cool.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. And then like when I finished it, I just got kind of frustrated because doing something like this is so not easy. Easy is the wrong word. But so much, like I tried for months and months to try to recreate this when I was in college, this kind of look digitally, and it's so relatively easy now to do it.
Oh, interesting.
Like,
yeah,
like to digitally make a print, like a printmaking kind of look without actually printing any of this stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, like you could do it before using Illustrator and Photoshop and scanning stuff, but Procreate makes it super, super easy.
Yeah, I am very impressed.
It's also pretty funny, if I can say so.
Yes, it is actually very funny. Yeah, I love it that it's like essentially an inside joke about the chapter. Like if you saw that, you might not immediately reference it as like part of Lord of the Rings, but like yes, it is a really good description of this chapter. And I just imagine like a kind of weird Mario or Zelda like hybrid of that monster just like popping out of the water and shooting something at you.
Yeah, that funny little like that design is pretty commonly used, which is so funny.
What do you say the octopus ball is called? Takoyaki.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I think I have actually had those, believe it or not.
Pretty good. We might have, you know what? We might have had them. I think we did have them together when we went to Goo.
Goo, yeah, definitely, yeah. I think they come with like bonito flakes that are all hot and like sort of blowing in the wind
on
top.
Yeah,
yeah. Damn good.
That was the first time I had them, and when I was like, when I realized how good they were. And then I had no idea what they were at that point.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
We were like three beers deep on those giant 1 liter beers.
Memories.
Yeah.
Mike, do you know that that I share an alleyway with what is now Goo and their receiving door?
I didn't know that exactly, but I knew that your work was right beside it because I visited you at work one day and went there for lunch after.
Oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, well, yeah, in the alleyway where I get my deliveries of art supplies, they and another restaurant also receive all their deliveries.
So will there ever be just a crate of octopus?
Okay, you know what? I'll say this. They get their grease traps cleaned, what I would say is surprisingly often.
That's good to hear, actually.
Yeah, actually, when I worked down the street at the bike shop, like actually very close by, we shared a back alleyway with a sushi place that was next to us that would have a lineup like every day. And, you know, back in the before times, this was people would be like killing time in the bike shop before their like sushi reservation. And you're like, oh, okay, great. You're here not to buy anything. But that alleyway was fucking disgusting. it constantly smelled like hell. Whereas my current alleyway with goo is actually like quite clean. They do a good job.
Wow, that's good to hear, actually.
Yeah, it is.
I like that restaurant. It's good to hear that I'm not taking my life in my hands every time I enter.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. I probably would have warned you otherwise.
Yeah, don't go in there. Their alley is hell. They had an octopus there for 6 hours.
It was spitting rocks at me and trying to pinch me.
It knocked on my door.
Thank you for listening to episode 16 of That Hobbit Shit. We are on Instagram at That Hobbit Shit. We are on Twitter at Hobbit Shit. If you would like to support the show, get yourself some Hobbit Shit merch. That is patreon.com/thathobbitshit. If you'd also like to fund us to summon Christopher Tolkien to ask any of your questions during a seance, patreon.com/thathobbitshit. And of course, if we skipped a dragon, thathobbitshit@gmail.com. And thank you to our supporters on Patreon. Thank you to Chris, Judy, Jeremy, and David, and Nicole. And of course, that's it. I'm Corey.
And I'm Mike.
And may the hair on your toes
never fall.
Seamless.